from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Dan Schellenbarger. After an 18-year career in British television as a presentation director, Lee Child lost his job and he found writing at the age of 40-ish. He joins us today to talk about his latest thriller, 61 Hours, which is the 14th book in the Jack Reacher series. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure, Dan. Good to be here.
I wanted to just talk a little bit about you, and I got this off of your website, and it's great, right at the very bottom part in your description. It says, Lee has three homes, an apartment in Manhattan, a country house in the south of France, and whatever airplane cabin he happens to be in while traveling between the two. In the U.S., he drives a supercharged, I believe you'd say Jaguar, which was built in Jaguar's Browns Lane plant, 30 yards from the hospital in which he was born. Lee spends his spare time reading, listening to music, and watching the Yankees, Aston Villa, or Marseille soccer. He's married with a grown-up daughter. He's tall and slim, and this is the best part, despite an appalling diet and refusal to exercise. This already sounds like a man of mystery and intrigue.
Yeah, well, it's true. Not so much Marseille soccer anymore because I'm in France less than I was, but the appalling diet is still there. And for me, running is strictly for emergencies. The last time I ran was probably 35 years ago.
In your press materials, I see you, and there's this one where you have laying out in front of you some tools of cutting a steak and a glass of scotch. You seem to have this manly sort of...
Well, you know, you're at the mercy of photographers for those things. And actually, I know the picture you mean. It's kind of reddish.
Yes, yes.
And that was done in Bulgaria, of all places. And so that's some Bulgarian photographer's idea of how I should be pictured.
Now, your description is wonderful. It makes one almost instantly jealous of this lifestyle. But something that may perhaps make people even more jealous is how you got into writing. I understand that you actually had a hardship, but you didn't experience the hardship that many writers go through in trying to get published.
Yeah, maybe the two things were connected in a sense. As you said in the intro, I worked 18 years in British television and actually loved it. It was a great, great job, a great company. I had a great time until one day my boss said something to me that made it impossible for me to continue. He said, "You're fired." And so it was a question of being out of work and what was I going to do next. And the fact that you're out of work means that you concentrate that little bit more. This writing to me was not a hobby. It was not a kind of want-to-do thing. It had to work. And I think that is a big component, frankly. If it's ultra dead serious, succeed or starve, then you do it a little bit differently. So I fortunately did not have the usual obstacles. Most people have a couple of manuscripts that fail. Most people get rejected by a bunch of agents and then get rejected by a bunch of publishers before they find some measure of success. But for me, I was so set on it. It had to work that my passage into it was pretty easy.
Now, your job in British television, it wasn't just a simple, like, you're fired. You had worked with very closely with the family. You had become quite close and working. So you had this whole support environment while you were where you were doing there. And you had a warning that there was a new management change and things. So what was that like, being basically mid-career, mid-life, and then all of a sudden you're faced with, well, this is how you were going to get your pension?
Yeah, well, it was tough. It was a miserable time because it had been a great company and everybody, including me, had worked with tremendous loyalty and application in the way that you do, you know, rather naively. And this happens to millions of people, that you work for the company and you expect something in return. And then under certain circumstances, that doesn't happen and you get thrown out. And it was a miserable time. But we had an extremely complicated job with many, many different components, and it took basically 2 years to replace us. So we had this two-year warning period during which little tiny parts of the job were lopped off every couple of months. And so we'd gone through all those, whatever they call it, nine stages by the time we left. You know, I was ready to go by the end of it. I was accepting of it, and I was looking ahead and ready to go. And it was a crucial time. You know, I was just about to turn 40, and that is halfway through your working years, essentially. And so it was simply a question of, if not now, when? You know, this is the time to do something. And it was a fairly binary choice. You either moved up, or if you stayed in that failing industry, you would just spiral downward. So it was a question of take the chance of moving ahead or settle for the certainty of spiraling down.
You were married.
Yeah.
as you are, and you had a child still living at home?
Yeah, 15 years old, and mortgage, credit cards, car loan, all that stuff.
Now, when you decided to be a writer, was it something that you'd been working on the side and said, okay, I'm gonna pull out this script, which I believe became The Killing Floor, mm-hmm. right? Or was it like, I'm going to write?
Yeah, it was the second. I, curiously enough, about 5 years before, I had a premonition, or actually not really a premonition, I just knew it would happen because I'm not dumb. I could see the way the industry was going. And I figured that, you know, our number would be up sooner or later. And I thought, well, what can I do? And I had always been a reader, loved reading, read thousands and thousands of books. And in the latter years, I began to see what the writer was doing and how he was doing it and why he was doing it. But I filed that away really as a curiosity because I was too busy with the day job. But I did have a sense that when all this comes to an end, then I'm going to try writing books. And then, of course, it did come to an end. And so I had to put up or shut up.
Now, you were working as a program director,
mm-hmm.
in a sense. And one of the great things about television is that you don't really need to describe a scene. It's there.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a fundamental difference in writing a novel versus writing or having a show prepared for television. Did you have any type of mechanistic changes of your mind while you were creating your book? Or did your television experience, do you think, help you visualize what you needed to describe in your books?
Yeah, it definitely did. Of course, it helped to visualize. And I think there's a further step that you have to take, which is that the audience is not immersed in only one thing. You know, the book audience also watches television, which also watches movies. Which also travels and has various experiences. So I think the thing to do was to, with as few words as possible, maybe just half a sentence or a short sentence, trigger something that is already in the reader's head. In other words, the reader has seen all these scenes on television. They know what the seedy part of town looks like. They know what the wide open spaces look like because they've seen it a dozen times in other media. And so if you can trigger that pre-existing memory in the reader, you actually save yourself a lot of description and you create a much faster pace in the book because you're not stopping for several pages to describe a scene that the reader already knows. So I think that we can cross-pollinate between the media in that sense. It's no point in pretending that the book reader doesn't watch television or doesn't watch movies. You may as well exploit that fact.
What about your writing process? What do you go through? I have a little article here about the author of The Alchemist, and he talks about how he wakes up every morning at 9 a.m., which is also enviable, and he says, by 11 o'clock, I'm going to be at the typewriter. That's when he pulls himself from a walk, and he says, by 12 o'clock, I'm going to be there. So at 3 o'clock, he pulls himself from the bar, and he realizes at 10 o'clock, he hasn't done anything. He's filled with guilt, and he just pounds it out. And you hear about people being looking at a blank page. You have 14 novels.
Yeah, and you know, the 14th is obviously cumulatively a little easier because I can say to myself, look, you've done this 13 times already. Don't panic. If you envy him for getting up at 9, I actually get up nearer 11. And I start work around 12 or 1. And for me, it's I don't sit there and do nothing. For me in particular, a lot of writers in general, it's a second phase thing. To some extent, it's either a destination that we've devoutly wished for, or else it is saving our bacon in some way, which is my situation. And so you're not going to screw it up by being lazy or indisciplined. So I do allow myself the luxury of getting up very late, but then I start work and I do some work. Every day I do some work and move the story along.
So do you set times? Are you precise with, you know, I need to write 2 or 3 hours or 18 pages or anything? Do you have anything that you hold yourself up against as a metric?
Not really in terms of word count, because I think that can be an illusion. You know, a great day could be 700 words if you are tackling a very difficult transition in the book. On the other hand, 2,000 words could be a breeze if it's flowing really well at that point. So you can't limit yourself, can't judge by the word count. What I do is I usually have about 5 or 6 hours during which time I'm working at peak efficiency. Obviously, you could work much longer than that, but there's really no point because after a certain point, the quality just begins to tail off a little bit to the point where you would only delete it anyway. So my peak hours extend to sort of 5 or 6 in a row, and I just work for those hours and then pack it in and start the next day.
You have a Again, it's kind of interesting where Jack Reacher is a very private person. You can just Google Lee Child, and I took a tour of your apartment just the other day. Yeah. Very beautiful apartment in New York. But from what I gathered, you have a minimal, nice, beautiful, modernist living space that you were quite particular. I read somewhere about 12 architects or something gave you help with this in the renovation. But you actually have a separate room where you or a separate apartment where you actually do your writing.
Yeah, that's true. I live on the 25th floor of my building, and that is the minimalist space. I just afforded myself the luxury of having it come out exactly how I wanted it. And then I have another apartment 18 floors below, which is my office. And that is an office, you know, which tends to be much more chaotic.
And does that help with the creative process?
Yeah, I mean, it turned out in a way that I didn't expect. The office obviously is an office, and therefore it is messy because, you know, things are going on. Because it's not just writing. I mean, there's an awful lot of regular office stuff to be done, you know, the accounting and the email and all that kind of stuff. So the office is just an office. But the living space, the idea was to indulge my taste for minimalist decor, which I expected to find very satisfying, because it is actually satisfying to live in a place that you've designed. But actually, it's more than that. It's very serene. It's a very serene and relaxing space, because what I know about myself in retrospect is that I'm such a word guy. If there are any words on display, any books on display or anything like that, then to a certain level, I'm always engaged. I'm reading them. I mean, right now we're sitting here in this studio, but my mind is roaming around, looking at all the words everywhere and picking up on them, which is to a certain extent distracting. So in the very bland, minimalist space, I find that extremely relaxing, and I think it probably helps my productivity.
Well, kind of speaking about the creative process, here you have 14 novels on Jack Reacher. Do you find writing about the same character, we find out about his stats and everything, we learn a little bit more about his background through each of the novels. Do you find that confining, or is that some way, okay, I know this character, so now my creativity can go to creating these scenarios that he has to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that distinguishes my series, the Reacher series, from practically every other series there is that it is not either location-based or employment-based. In other words, he's not a cop in Chicago, or he's not a private eye in Los Angeles. He is an ex-military policeman who is a drifter and a loner, which means that he can be anywhere and do anything, which I think is much more liberating, much more flexible. If he were, let's say, a cop in Chicago, then every book, by now 14 of them, would have to be about plausible cop work in that city, which might get a little restrictive. But Reacher can be any place and do anything, not only geographically in terms of scale, but in terms of pitch. Some of the books are big, glossy things that involve the White House and the FBI and the Secret Service and international stuff. Some of them are just no-account little towns in the middle of nowhere, like 61 Hours, set in South Dakota.
Freezing cold. It's a great summer read. Cool down, chill out a little bit. Yeah. Very cold.
Air conditioning for 20-some bucks. It's and, you know, that's the flexibility that Reacher has, that you're not in a corner. You're not painted into a single track. And so, no, I don't get bored of him, because there's really not much that he can't do.
Why don't we actually step inside the book? And if you have an excerpt, this would be a great time to read a few pages in here.
Well, I'm just going to read a very, very brief little piece, because the difficulty with reading from a suspense book is really, what can you read apart from the beginning? But there is a little bit close to the beginning, which is kind of sums up Jack Reacher. And he's with a couple of cops, and they've had a standoff with a couple of biker types who apparently are meth dealers. And Reacher has dealt with both of them in spectacular fashion. And the story goes like this. The two guys lay close together, black humps on the moonlit ice, steam rising off them in a cloud. Peterson said nothing more. Holland stalked back to his unmarked car and used the radio and came back a long minute later and said, I just called for two ambulances. He was looking straight at Reacher. Reacher didn't respond. Holland asked, you want to explain why I had to call for two ambulances? Reacher said, because I slipped. What? On the ice. that's your story? You slipped and just kind of blundered into them? No, I slipped when I was hitting the big guy. It softened the blow. If I hadn't slipped, you wouldn't be calling for two ambulances. You'd be calling for one ambulance and one coroner's wagon. Holland looked away. Peterson said, go wait in the car. That's the kind of guy Reacher is. If he'll leave you alone, but if you push him, he'll push back, and you don't want Reacher pushing back at you.
Stephen King in Entertainment Weekly writes about man fiction writers. And he lists blah, 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 a couple of competitions, but he saves your name. He says the best. He's the best of the best. But then he goes on. He talks about the popularity of your books, not just with the guy types, but the gal types. So it's both the men and women. And he says, women like stories in which the gal meets a handsome and possibly dangerous hunk on a tropical isle. Men like to imagine going to war against an army of bad guys with a Beretta, a blowtorch, and a submachine gun. Grenades hung on the belt are optional. And I think about that, but I also think that Jack Reacher really isn't that kind of guy. I mean, he doesn't even have a suitcase, really.
Right.
And when I was looking through your publicity photos, I noticed that there were a lot of women in the audience. So can you explain that?
Well, it's tough to explain. I mean, it's certainly a fact. I think, we have to accept that women are much more communicative anyway, so that there will always be a larger percentage of women show up at book events because they're less inhibited about showing up and actually saying, I like this. You know, men have got all these issues about, I don't know what, but, you know, it's difficult for a man to come up and say, I love your stuff, whereas it's easier for a woman to do it. So there will always be more women, but in my audience, the women are way overrepresented. There are many more than there ought to be. And so why is that? And I think it's because of a bunch of reasons that Reacher really appeals to them for two or three different reasons. One being that Reacher has almost a feminine sense of justice. Women generally, I think, in my experience, are offended by injustice much more than men. Men are all accommodating about gray areas and so on. Women are capable of just feeling it's not fair, damn it. And Reacher is the guy that will make it fair. And they appreciate that story arc, I think, very much. Also, there's the element of the bad boy. You know, he's the wild man who has... There are two possibilities. Either they can tame him and look after him, or they can just enjoy him for a couple of days, and then he'll hit the road and never come back, which is kind of reassuring.
He seems perhaps like a bad boy, but also proper. He seems to have still, he doesn't seem immoral or like he would do anything that's out of the call of just generally gentlemanly behavior.
I think that's that's a very nice word you just used. He's a gentleman in that old-fashioned, courtly way, decent, fair, pleasant man, except if he's offended by some attack, then he'll respond. But yeah, he's a thoroughly decent man with a heart of gold underneath that very rough, tough exterior. Because what I was really trying to do with the character was to go back beyond the modern or postmodern type of thriller hero, which tends to be kind of miserable and dysfunctional and alcoholic or recovering alcoholic or wounded or traumatized in some bitter way. I was bored with that, and I wanted to go back to a more ancient form of hero that is the knight errant.
Yes.
The heart of gold. And he will do the right thing. And he does have an old-fashioned kind of courtesy and gentlemanly quality about him that I think is immensely reassuring.
And there's a theatrical feel to how he appears and then disappears.
Yeah, which is part of the legend. I mean, that's a legend that I'm sure, as you could analyze for us, goes back centuries, if not millennia. The mysterious stranger who shows up in the nick of time, cleans up the town, and then rides off into the sunset. It was a Western construct, but not invented by the Westerns, because it existed hundreds of years previously in Europe. The knight errant mysteriously showing up, dealing with the trouble, and then vanishing. Parallel tracks in other cultures, the Ronin in Japan, going back further, the Norse sagas, Beowulf, this guy has always been there. And so Reacher is really a connection with a very ancient form of hero that has been developed to the point, I think, of corruption in the modern era with this dysfunctional, miserable type of hero?
When I first got the copy, an advanced copy of the book, I expected, oh, this is good. I have a couple of weeks, and I'll be able to take some time in this. I read it in 2 days.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a point like, I just need to know what's going to happen next. But I start out, I try to read, and I look or try to hear the author's voice. And we have this countdown going on. Uh-huh. So I'm aware of you, but very quickly, I find myself just ignorance of the author and very much looking at what is happening inside and how the different characters are dealing with that. How do you decide when you dip in as the author and be the omniscience as opposed to letting the characters kind of act it out and carry the plot?
I think it's a very instinctive thing, and I think it's actually rooted in history, because we don't know how long we've had stories, but we can assume it's many tens of thousands of years. And yet, only really in the past 150 years have we consumed stories written down on the page. You know, before early 19th century, I think most people got stories orally. In other words, they would sit around and listen to a storyteller. So when you say voice, a lot of theory talks about voice as if it was some vague stylistic issue. But to me, voice is literally that. It's the voice of a storyteller. And I think we can all imagine sitting there listening to somebody tell a story, and they will dip in and out of their own exposition and then the live action, as it were, and back and forth in a rather subtle and instinctive way that carries you through the story. And as far as the countdown went, all thrillers, I think, have the implication of a ticking clock or a countdown of some kind. It doesn't have to be fast necessarily. I mean, some great thrillers are slow and ominous in terms of the pacing, but it's there, the regular heartbeat of the book. So I thought, well, let's just put it up front. Let's make it a kind of exoskeleton with the ticking clock absolutely visible in our faces and see how that works. And I was happy with the way it came out. It creates this tremendous propulsion and this sort of dread. You know, what is coming in 59 hours, 58 hours, 57 hours? What's going to happen?
I'm always afraid to talk about novels that I don't want to give away anything, and I don't want to be punched in the face by the author. When I was reading this, I did feel that there's a sense of good, that the good guys are going to win. And I've read some other interviews where you talk about that you kind of give the reader what we all want, a sense of justice. What are you trying to do with these novels?
Well, I think it's a good point, because people refer to this as a noir fiction, which it absolutely is not, really. I mean, noir is kind of bad things happening to bad people and good people alike, and these are not really like that. This is good guys versus bad guys, and the good guys will win. You can count on it. They will win spectacularly. Because I think what fiction is for, essentially, is it's about a consolation or a compensation. It gives us what we don't get in our real life. And there are all kinds of satisfactions and closures that we don't get in our real life. You know, if your house is burgled, they're not going to catch the guys. You're not going to get your stuff back. It's all thoroughly unsatisfactory. But in a book, yes, of course they're going to catch the guys. And of course you're going to get your stuff back. There's a happy ending to it. There's satisfaction. And so that's what I'm giving people with these books, the misery and unfairness of injustice, but then it is put right. The danger and peril, and then safety and order at the end. I think it's a terrific, sustaining human arc. I think we've needed it all along, and I think we still need it now.
How do you, Lee Child, judge if your work is good or bad?
Just what you said a couple of minutes ago, you read it in 2 days. Or if I get letters saying I stayed up all night and I was tired at work the next day. One day a woman enclosed her manicure bill because she chewed her fingernails reading the book. That's the only way you can tell whether it's worked. Has somebody actually engaged with it? Have they been unable to put it down? And that's the only measure.
Do you find yourself measuring by book sales in terms of, well, if it sells a lot, that means the audience likes it, and so that was a better Reacher novel than novel 8 or something like that?
Well, typically these things build up a momentum. So the fact that novel 14 will undoubtedly sell more than novel 8 is not necessarily a measure of respective quality. It's just a measure of the momentum that the series has achieved. I mean, I love sales. Yeah, absolutely. I love to sell as many books as possible. But it's more about the quality of the enjoyment that people get out of it. If they have a thoroughly good time for 2 days or a week while they're reading it, and they close the book and think, wow, that was pretty good, then I know I've done my job.
Do you think that now with our more and more access to information and kind of more awareness of what's going on, and, you know, we just think of all the things that are going on right now, socio-politically, nationally, all of these different things going on, that there's more of a need that when we have our entertainments, whether it's movies or literature or whatever we're going to, that we need things that confound us but then are imminently solvable?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think most of life is not solvable. Most of life is hard to understand and not very rational, and there doesn't seem to be any theme or purpose to it. And I think it is immensely reassuring to be able to go through a narrative arc where things ultimately do make sense. And you realize, yes, C happened because of A and B, and therefore the conclusion was D. In other words, we've undertaken a journey that is linear, rational, makes sense, and ends in a satisfying conclusion.
Have you thought about any other genres? Are you interested in doing nonfiction, or are we going to see a multitude more of Reacher novels?
I love reading everything. I mean, I read nonfiction a lot, and there's certainly a number of stories I would like to tell, but ultimately we only have a certain amount of time for writing. And I also think that the reader needs a certain amount of predictability in the marketplace. I think, based on what I feel as a reader, if there's a series that I love and the new book comes out by that author and it's not in the series, then I'm kind of irrationally ill-disposed towards that book. I mean, it could be the greatest book ever. It could be a Nobel Prize-winning book, but I'm still annoyed about it because it's not my next fix. And so I think there's a sort of implied bargain with the readers that they've supported this series through 14 books now, and I will keep on giving it to them. That's what they want. And writers are intensely individual, obviously, but together we make up a collective, so that if people get bored with Reacher, fine, go and read somebody else. And meanwhile, the people bored with those other people can come and read Reacher. Each one of us doesn't have to cover every base. You know, we can collectively cover every base.
What about a movie?
Well, you know, I'm not the person to ask. You've got to ask Hollywood about that. Certainly the rights are sold, the development is underway, but it has been for a number of years. And so what the holdup is, I'm not entirely sure. And they'll have to work it out on their own schedule, on their own time, because I love Hollywood. I love the people, I love the products, I love movies. But nobody would claim, I think, that it's a particularly rational way of working. So we shall see if anything happens or not.
It's funny because while reading this, I was trying to picture in my mind who this Reacher looks like. And I can't, and maybe it's because he's kind of squeaky clean. He doesn't have this dark background. And I'm like, well, this actor wouldn't know this, no, this, no, that actor wouldn't be good.
Yeah, so. It's very hard to cast. And I think that will be, you know, that's probably the main problem with it. But on the other hand, I worked with actors for nearly 20 years, and they're capable of acting. I mean, that's the name of the game. And so just because the guy you picture has done stuff in the past that is not exactly what you would imagine, and he doesn't look exactly like you think he should, if he gets into the part with a good script and a good director, then the end product is likely to surprise you. And so when they do announce the casting, if they do, I'm not going to panic about it in the short term. I'm going to wait and see what the movie's actually like before I make up my mind, because there are plenty of examples, dozens of examples of great movies that we would agree are perfectly cast that were disappointments at the beginning because they were going into it with their second or third choice. And yet now, having seen the movie in the theater, we think, wow, that was obvious.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to novel number 15. And once again, Lee Child's latest thriller is 61 Hours.
For more from Lee Child, visit www.writerstalk.org. Writers Talk is a production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University in conjunction with The Ohio Channel. where you can watch videos of our interviews at www.ohiochannel.org. Join us next time when we respond to your demands for more, and we talk to humorist Christopher Moore, author of Bite Me, and poet Julie Moore, author of Slipping Out of Bloom. When you want more, you know where to go. Writer's Talk. Until then, this is Doug Dankler from The Ohio State University saying, keep writing.